KLAK 1260 AM Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Cease and desist. That is the message Twitter is sending to Meta, accusing the company of misappropriating Twitter's trade secrets on its new Threads app. U.S. expected to announce as early as tomorrow it will provide cluster munitions to Ukraine in a new aid package. That's according to two officials.
The Russians have already been employing cluster munitions on the battlefield.
Pentagon spokesman Brigadier General Patrick Ryder. Drones now flying over some of New York State's beaches searching for sharks after four people were bitten this past weekend.
Having this vantage point, as we like to say, our eyes in the sky, gives us a completely different vantage point as lifeguards from what we're typically used to.
Lifeguarding supervisor at Jones Beach, Kerry Epstein. Maine's legislature has given final approval to a proposal to expand access to abortions later in pregnancy. Governor Janet Mills expected to sign the bill. Once she does, Maine will have one of the least restrictive abortion laws in the country. This is ABC News. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for a robust international police force to help fight Haiti's armed gangs. There is a new federal commitment to a New York train tunnel.
Gateway, the long-awaited second rail tunnel linking New Jersey with New York City, is closer to breaking ground. New York Senator Chuck Schumer announcing,
"Today, the light at the end of the tunnel is powered by a massive $6.88 billion federal grant to Gateway."
It's the largest amount ever awarded to a mass transit project. The need is dire. The current tunnels under the Hudson River, part of the Northeast Corridor, are more than 110 years old and were severely damaged by Hurricane Sandy. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Revising her story, researchers say a 5,000-year-old tomb in Spain actually contains the remains of a woman, not a man. The old thought was based on assumption because the cave had items indicating high social status. Female remains were confirmed with a new scientific method analyzing tooth enamel. Andy Field, ABC News.
Here's what you need to know in northwestern Wisconsin. Good afternoon, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Drought conditions in the western part of the state remained about the same in the latest drought monitor, which doesn't take into account for the rain that has fallen since Tuesday morning. Nearly the entire state, about 93% of it, is experiencing some form of drought, with the worst of it in southern Wisconsin and in far northern Wisconsin in Douglas County. The village of Lake Halley has passed ordinances aimed at curbing panhandlers and people living in vehicles. The village board unanimously passed the measures, which Police Chief Ed Orgon said come after complaints from businesses along Commercial Boulevard. Orgon added that first offenders would be given a warning. And after months of what he called targeted harassment, Amory Police Chief Steve Heinzel turned in his resignation. Heinzel said that he felt working conditions were intolerable. Social media posts critical of Amory's police department have added up to tens and even hundreds of thousands of views. The city council voted unanimously last night to begin searching for a new police chief. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I have Corrine Hendrickson, part of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed group.
It feels like they're trying to pit the teachers against the parents, and all of us can come together to say, look, stop trying to, you know, divide and conquer and work with us. And they're still trying to hide and say, well, the JFC cut it, there's nothing I can do. Yes, there is. You can vote for the amendment to continue child care count.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Wisconsin's home for daily conversations about the state's latest headlines and stories. Weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Protections.
Good. We will take what we can get. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm still fixated on Mike Pence's statement yesterday in Iowa. We don't need those rich people paying their fair share. No. He said, quote, I don't really buy into the rich need to pay their fair share. And again, you know, at least he's honest. You know, this is one of those moments you go, he's honest. He's telling you exactly what he thinks. Now, you have to decide which side are you on. And that's why I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come give us some thoughts. He's the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, also the co-author of Tax the Rich, How Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
Great so what to do you think show. Of Mike Pence's comment? You got any thoughts?
Well, I agree with you. It's good that he's being open about what he says. I will give the guy some credit. What he actually said was that the rich people pay almost all the taxes. And, well, it's true. There are poor people don't pay tax at all because poor people don't have any money. So depending on your definition of rich and poor, you could actually say rich people pay all of the taxes. And that just means our system is somewhat progressive. People with higher incomes pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes. To sort of be correct by Mike Pence's theory, we'd have to charge every person the same amount in dollars, you know? And I mean, that wouldn't work. It would mean poor people paying a lot more, and they don't have any more, and rich people paying a lot less. And I mean, I suppose if you want more inequality, that might work,
right?
But I don't think so.
Well, isn't that the crux of the flat tax argument? I get this all the time. What we need is a flat tax. Get those people who have skin in the game. And I'm going, no, a flat tax of 30%, you know, like the House Republicans proposed, 23 to start at upwards of 30%. That is a massive increase on working people.
Yes. And they can't afford it because they don't have that much money anyway. So it's kind of a ridiculous argument. I looked at some numbers, you know, Rick. I wasn't sure about percentages, but I took some IRS statistics. They publish statistics every year. Income, people with AGI above $1 million, okay? That's about 600,000 people in the whole country, okay? Well below 1% of the, well, it's about 0.4% of the taxpayers have an AGI of 1 million or above, less than half of 1%. Those people, but they have 20% of all the income. Okay, so one half of 1% of the people have 20% of all of the income. And it's true. They pay 33% of all of the taxes. but they need to because they have 10 times more income per person than everyone else does. So it's not really they're paying no more as a percentage of their income than everyone else is.
Right.
But of course they're paying more in absolute dollars because these are people with million-dollar incomes.
In fact, in a lot of states, Morris, you know, people at the bottom of the scale end up paying more as a percentage of their income than people at the top. I look at, you know, Pennsylvania has that flat tax and it's upside down where the very wealthy, you know, they pay, you know, with sales tax and everything else, are paying a much lower percent of their income in taxes than someone making minimum wage.
Oh, sure. All of the flat tax states, I mean, all of the states that get most of their income from sales tax, people who have enough money they can save pay far lower percentage of their income in taxes than people who are actually living paycheck to paycheck because they're spending all of their money. And essentially the sales tax applies to their entire income. Versus someone like me, sales tax might apply to a very small part of your income if you're mostly saving money and not spending it all. It's just so unfair that we're expecting poor people to pay a higher percentage of their income for taxes than we are rich people. That's why the rich are getting richer. And those people who are working for a living and driving trucks and teaching our children and taking care of us in the emergency room are just barely getting by and falling further and further behind every year.
Oh, it's interesting you bring that up because, you know, I had lunch today with a friend who was saying, look, you know, I'm fixated on the inflation. You know, the government's spending too much money and it's causing all this inflation. It's a theft. It's a theft from the poor and the working class. It's a theft because wages aren't keeping up and all this. And I'm going, yeah, but instead of focusing on cutting food stamps and cutting, you know, programs that help the poor, why don't we look at the other end of things, which this guy really wasn't doing because that's not what's been put right in front of him.
Yeah, we have to look at asking those people who are rich to pay more taxes. And yeah, that'll have an effect on the economy too. It's just kind of sad because, yeah, if you want to like cause a recession and make lots of people unemployed and lose their income, yeah, that will make the price of eggs and gas and other things like that stop going up. That's probably true. If no one can afford to buy any gas, the gas stations will have to lower the price of the gas, most likely. But I don't think that's the way we want our country to run. Yeah. I'd rather live in a place where lots of people can afford to buy lots of stuff. And yeah, if we have to pay a little bit more, that's okay. There was a time, Rick, when Democrats ran on inflation being a good thing. And you know why? It was because people making mortgage payments, their mortgage payments don't go up with inflation. That's the one thing that does not go up with inflation. The bankers that are receiving those mortgage payments, they're the ones who get hurt by inflation because the value of that payment stream 30 years in the future gets decimated.
Right. But the difference, Morris, was, and you know, I talk about this all the time because my grandparents, you know, basically lived what you were saying. They bought a house in the late 60s, and by the mid 70s, their mortgage payment was a day's pay because their union contracts had cost of living adjustments. Whereas inflation went up, they got raises to keep up with inflation so that their wages weren't eroded by it. We don't have that today.
We need that.
Of course we do.
We need and more power for people that are working to see their wages go up with inflation. That's what we're supposed to have. That's what we need.
But the other side's going to tell you, Morris, but that's going to cause more inflation. You're just going to make the problem worse.
Oh, it's just so sad. We need the people that are hurt by inflation are the people who have lots of money because they're the ones with purchasing power getting eroded. The ones who don't have any money, they have nothing to erode. And if you have a big debts, like if you owe a lot of money on your credit cards and your mortgage and your car payments and all of this, even if your wages only go up a little, your debts don't go up at all. And you're the ones who are actually helped by some inflation. It's just sad that people are really thinking about doing the bidding of the rich when because they listen to your competitors too much, I guess, Rick.
Well, no, I mean, that's what they're told. You know, we need low inflation and we need to do, you know, make products cheap so you can go out and buy your cheap plastic crap from China. But your wages have been stagnant for 40 years and declining as healthcare erodes more of your wages and your retirement security is gone because it's all now, hey, if you can't afford to put money away, you don't get a retirement. We're heading into a crisis moment. And here we are divided and pitted against each other over basic nonsense. You know, yesterday on the program, we talked about this guy from South Africa, Johan Rupert, I think his name was. Where, you know, back in 2015 was talking about, hey, maybe we should start planning for the future, for all the jobs that are going to be lost. Maybe we should start planning for the structural unemployment that's coming. Maybe we should start, oh, I don't know, thinking about what we're going to do. And here we are all these years later, still having done nothing to help the working class and the working poor.
That's the whole point of our patriotic millionaires, is that we are trying to get rich people, investors, business people to speak out and say, we don't want to live in a country with a few rich people and lots of poor people. That does not work. You can't make money if no one can afford to buy whatever it is you're trying to sell them. And we have to explain that to our government, that having half of our population being poor does not work for anybody. And we need to not take money away from the poor people, which is what I think Mike Pence wants to do. He was complaining about Social Security and Medicaid and these things taking up too much money. We need to have the people who have all the money give up some of that so that the people who don't have any money can get some. And yeah, if you want to complain that our tax system is a little bit progressive, that's the most ridiculous complaint I've ever heard. Of course, rich people pay all the taxes because they have all the money. And you can't, what were you expecting?
Excellent point. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Morris Pearl. Morris is the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires. Check out their website, patrioticmillionaires.org. We'll get links out on social media. Also the co-author of the book, Tax the Rich, How Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer. Now, I'm sure you saw the job numbers coming out today as President Biden is on the Invest in America tour, finally getting out and highlighting some of the manufacturing that's being reshored, some of the projects that are being created and the jobs that are being created. In fact, the job numbers, 497,000 today, blowing away expectations. Thoughts on Bidenomics and where it's leading us?
I mean, a lot of people are getting jobs. Some of them are building those car recharging stations and things like that. So some of it's working, and you know, some of it's good luck or bad luck or the weather or this or that. I mean, you can blame a lot of things, but yeah, people who have all this money from these stimulus programs and the Inflation Reduction Act are spending the money. And that means the businesses in their communities are selling more stuff and hiring more people. And that helps everybody do better. When people have more money to spend, that trickles up. Money does not trickle down from the rich, like the trickle-down theory says. Money trickles up from the people that have very little. And the way to make everyone do better is to distribute money to the people at the bottom, whether it's higher wages or tax credits or the EITC or the CTC, or any of the programs that help the people that have very little, because they spend all of the money they're given. Having a program to help rich people get richer helps that one guy. Having a program to help people that are working for a living to have a little bit more money in their take home every week, that's what helps everybody.
Yeah, I had an economics professor on the program probably about 10 years ago, and he asked me a question that, you know, is one of those things that have stuck with me all these years. He said, you know, if you're a business owner, what do you want? Do you want a tax break for $20,000 or do you want 20,000 customers? And, you know, it was, you know, it's one of those interesting moments where, you know, what one side is saying, we're going to give all these tax breaks to these businesses and not give that money to the customers, to disposable income, to the working people who would then end up giving the money to the business anyway. And I thought it was an interesting question.
Yeah, because the business guy only paid taxes on his profits. If he's not making profits, he's not paying any taxes at all. So all the tax breaks in the world aren't going to do him any good. What the business guy needs is more profits so he can pay more taxes, not less taxes. You know, I was saying before, we were at a meeting today where people complaining about their fees, they pay the credit card companies. And I say, I'd rather pay more fees to the credit card companies because we get more customers paying with credit cards.
That seems like common sense to me.
Because there's so much short-sightedness in people. It's like the business guy, you know, who's the Republican, is sitting there looking at his tax return. He's saying, oh my God, I'm paying thousands of dollars in taxes. If I didn't pay those thousands of dollars in taxes, I'd have more money in my pocket. But he doesn't think about the fact that the reason he's paying thousands of dollars in taxes is because he made lots of profits. And that the way to have more money in his pocket is actually to have more taxes because he has more profits. And then he'll be richer and he'll have more workers and he'll have more satisfied customers. But people, they don't look at things that way.
Yeah.
They're very myopic and short-sighted.
No, and lastly, I wanted to get in because, you know, I said a while ago and I had a bunch of people going, that doesn't make any sense. I said, you know, when we had a much higher tax rate, you could think 1950s, 1960s, wages continued to go up because, you know, people didn't want to pay those high tax rates. So they gave better benefits and better wages to workers. They invested in new plants. They invested in new material and equipment and hospitals and schools because they didn't want to pay high tax rates to the government. That money was then used in the community in the way that they saw they wanted to see fit. And you know, higher wages were a part of that.
And on average, those people were happier than they are now. It's just...
No, that's an excellent point. You know, I had a very rich uncle who he was miserable. I mean, it was, you know, he had this jealousy complex and this anger of, you know, people, you know, it was just a weird kind of thing. The guy had everything he could possibly want. Was one of the most miserable people I've ever met.
It's the people who are, because the people who are trying to be greedy, they're always thinking that other people are trying to cheat them because they're trying to cheat other people. It's the people who are generous. They kind of assume that other people are being generous and they're happier people.
If only we could get back to those moments. But Morris, I appreciate the thoughts. Good stuff as always. Hope folks will check out the website, patrioticmillionaires.org. Get the book, Tax the Rich, How Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer, co-authored by our good friend Morris Pearl. Morris, again, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Great to be in your show.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. From the top.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, it's one of those things that, you know, when Morris brought it up, you know, about people being unhappy, you know, I thought about this uncle who, you know, was you know, a very successful business guy and was angry that people would have the audacity to question his benevolence. And you get that kind of benevolent dictator kind of scenario that workers, you know, were demanding better wages, hours, benefits, all that stuff. And he took it all personally. I mean, it was all, you know, an affront to him, and was very angry. You know, and in fact, you know, he had always been a fairly conservative Democrat. But, you know, when Trump came along, you know, huge swing over to the Trump side of things, because, you know, he believed the pendulum had gone too far. Workers were demanding too much. They were coddled. And I just remember, you know, thinking, you know, this is somebody who has whatever he wants, has the money to do whatever he wants, go wherever he wants, you know, all of this stuff, and somehow really unhappy with it. And, you know, it's one of those things where the more you have, I don't know, the Scrooge, the miser, I don't know. The more you have, the more miserable you become, because, you know, this idea that, you know, someone's got to come and take it from me, which is interesting. Now, what Morris said makes a lot of sense. I've said in the past, and people have questioned me, you know, I said, you know, if I were around in the 50s, I would have loved to have paid the, you know, the 92% tax rate. Would have loved to been able to pay that. In fact, I actually know a guy whose father was one of those people during World War II who was paying that high tax rate and was proud to do it. And I remember questioning him going, proud to do it? He goes, yeah, he was proud to be able to contribute that kind of resource, you know, to the war effort and all that. Was very patriotic and all that stuff. But more importantly, he was proud to do it because he was making a boatload of money. He was up at the top of the game. So, yeah, you know, you want to make sure that, you know, people are out there, you know, keeping the streets safe and keeping the neighborhood, you know, intact so things don't devolve. And as we talked about yesterday with this Johann Rupert, you know, I don't believe he was doing it out of benevolence. I don't believe he was saying, hey, we got to figure out this tsunami of job loss that's coming. We got to figure out this structural unemployment that's going to be permanent, where people are never going to find jobs because there aren't going to be any. We've got to figure out how to do this. Again, back in 2015, giving this speech. Now, as I believe it was in radical self-interest, you know, as the, you know, the head of Cartier, who sells really expensive stuff, you want rich people feeling comfortable buying really expensive stuff. And his argument was, is, you know, if your neighbor loses his job, you know, you're not going to buy that new car or that you know, shiny diamond or whatever, because, well, you don't want them knowing what you got, because they may come over and take it from you. And that's what happens in desperate places. So when I look at someone like Morris, and look, I like Morris a lot. A lot of this is radical self-interest. I want to make sure that I'm safe. I want to make sure I don't have to live behind an iron gate. I want to make sure I don't want to have, I don't need, you know, five bodyguards to walk me down the street in New York. Morris is a guy, and I've seen it, you know, him and his wife, you know, got good on them. You know, they just, you know, they're just walking around on the street, like, just like anybody else. And he's one of the wealthiest guys I know. But back to radical self-interest, wants to be able to do that. And you can only do that in a society where you don't have widespread desperation and the kind of inequality that we're heading toward. This is why wages have to keep coming up, which is why, you know, someone like Morris would go, yeah, we need stronger unions. We need stronger unions. And he's right. You know, Democrats, we're okay with inflation because inflation helps debtors. And what did we have, you know, during the 1970s? You know, we had a lot of, my grandparents came back from World War II, bought homes, and were in debt. And, you know, by the end of the inflationary period, their mortgages were a joke, a day's pay. And they were able to build wealth, and they were able to pay off their homes and retire with dignity. All of that. Reagan forward this fixation on can't have any inflation. And we need to stop inflation by crushing unions and crushing a demand for wage increases, which is why over the last 40 plus years, we haven't seen the kind of wage inflation that you would need to keep an economy going. Now, look, I'm not an economist. This stuff just makes sense. It just makes sense. But again, you know, I come back to the policies that keep popping up, the things that, that are allowed to continue to happen, and move us in a direction of smart policy. I think Biden's helping that. I think Biden is potentially able to change the direction of this country in a way that is going to be very helpful. If only he could articulate it. Reshoring manufacturing and you know, rebuilding our infrastructure, but also talking about tax increases. We need to go back to the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower's tax code. We need to tax the rich. Pretty simple, I think. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. We'll take a quick break. We're going to find out what's going on with UPS and the Teamsters. Will there be a strike? Back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1911. That was the day that the song The Preacher and the Slave first appeared in the Little Red Songbook. The Little Red Songbook was a compilation of labor songs published by the Industrial Workers of the World Union. The booklet was pocket-sized so labor activists could carry it with them wherever they would go. Music was an important part of the IWW labor culture. Joe Hill was probably the most well-known of the IWW songwriters. Many of the songs penned during this era are still sung at labor rallies and meetings today. But not everyone appreciated the music and the message of the IWW, a radical union that called for all workers to unite together. When IWW activists, or Wobblies as they were called, would give speeches, they would sometimes be heckled and jeered. Authorities would harass and break up meetings. Sometimes, Salvation Army brass bands that were competing for space and audiences on street corners would disrupt IWW rallies with their music. Joe Hill wrote his song, The Preacher and the Slave, in response to this musical disruption. He set the lyrics to the tune of the hymn In the Sweet By and By. Often, IWW songwriters satirized hymns played by the Salvation Army, which the Wobblies dubbed the Starvation Army. The lyrics tell of long-haired preachers who tell workers to stop agitating because they will eat by and by. The song was a critique of religious leaders who did not help working people. It became one of the most popular Joe Hill tunes.
Long-haired preachers come out every night. They try to tell you what's wrong. Right.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Two pieces of good advice. Never sign nothing by neon. And never negotiate with snakes. But Joe Biden violated both rules this year, getting out-negotiated by Senate Republicans and their tag-along Democrat Joe Manchin. As a result, Biden completely surrendered an urgently needed program for America, universal child care. The U.S. child care system is broken at every level. Availability is scarce, and even if parents can find an opening, the price is forbidding. Yet, care providers and teachers are grossly underpaid. So we're doomed by corporate greed and Washington's indifference, right? Wrong. Grassroots people across the country are demanding and getting real change at the state level. Last year, for example, voters in New Mexico rallied a decade-long care rebellion to put a landmark initiative on the ballot to guarantee that all children ages 0 to 5 have a constitutional right to quality early childhood education. Moreover, Amendment 1 allocates a steady stream of money from New Mexico's land-grant permanent fund to make this promise real. The vote initiative passed with 70% of the vote. Vermont, led by such persistent grassroots groups as Let's Grow Kids, is providing $130 million a year to establish a solid base for universal child care. Last month, the Republican governor vetoed the funding provision, but a bipartisan legislative majority, prodded by public demand, has now voted to override the veto. Also, the red state legislature in Tennessee is providing a new and essential child care benefit to low-income parents of infants and toddlers, diapers. And even some in the U.S. Congress are beginning to get the child care message, having formed the first-ever Congressional Dads Caucus to push family-friendly policies. This is Jim Hightower saying, when leaders won't lead, the people must shove them out of the way.
¶¶
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, like we talked about yesterday, doesn't look good for the negotiations between the Teamsters and UPS. Both sides pointing fingers, saying the other one walked away. And as I said before, don't care who walked away, who walked away from the table, get back to it. And if you're not going to use the table, let's put it out on the picket lines so folks can, can set up the information and set up some snacks and start marching on the picket line. But here to share some thoughts on what's going on, I've asked our good friend Richard Hooker to come talk with you. He's the Secretary Treasurer of Teamsters Local 623 right now, this minute, at one of the UPS locations doing a practice picket. So we've got Richard on the line. Richard, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what's going on? What are you doing and why are you doing it?
Well, right now we're just getting ready for the practice picketing. We're getting our members pumped up about this. We're going to combine it with a July 13th rally. We want to make sure that our members understand what is going on because this is very, very important. We are here right now at the Oregon Avenue facility to make sure that our members know what the issues are, what the strike is going to look like, what it means for their families, their benefits, and what we're really looking to get from UPS. So we right here right now at the gates now.
Now, as I said the last time we talked, what was leaked as the economic proposal was almost was really a slap in the face. That was almost a, yeah, we want you to go on strike. I don't know what the latest economic proposals were before the breakup at the table. Any ideas?
Rick, if you know, I know.
Yeah.
I'm a principal officer of in the Teamsters. I have the largest Teamsters local in Philadelphia. We have the second largest air hub in the country, the largest air hub on the East Coast, and I don't know. So, all we could do is wait and see what happens from the IBT. Hopefully that we'll get that information soon, because you want to know, I want to know, but our members want to know as well, and that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Because at this late in the game, our members are getting anxious. They're hearing a lot of rumors. They're seeing a lot of information on social media. They're hearing a lot of things. And that's what we don't need. We need to make sure that the information that we receive is the correct information. And only that can come from the National Negotiating Committee. So I'm hoping that we get that information soon, because, again, 3 weeks left is all we got.
Yeah, because I was under the impression that a deal had to be struck by the 5th, if I'm not mistaken, because of the time needed to run the ratification vote. We're past the 5th. So it looks to me like, a strike's going to happen. So the practice that you're putting in, obviously well needed. Now, I hope that doesn't happen for a bunch of reasons. I hope, members don't lose a paycheck. I hope that, UPS doesn't lose customers. I hope the economy doesn't come screeching to a halt. But ultimately, it comes down to the dignity and respect that's in each one of your members' pockets.
Absolutely. And that's really what this contract is basically about. It's about that dignity and respect. We haven't gotten it for decades. We've been giving them the sweat of our brow, the blood, the tears. The pandemic pushed us to the brink, and UPS made record profits. And so our members, they want to share in those profits. We're not looking to get rich. We're not greedy, which what they're trying to make us look like we are right now. We just want what's fair. And whenever you make somebody record profits, you should get a record-breaking contract as well.
No.
And that's all we're looking to get.
No, and this is one of these things, and I go back to one of the biggest slaps in the face, and we've talked about this already. I know in my area, and I don't know how it is in Philadelphia or in Des Moines or in Chicago or anywhere else, I know in my area, the people working on the inside, the part-timers, they were, during the pandemic, they were paying $24 an hour, because they needed people to get in the door. And then on an arbitrary day, they evidently just picked it out. They went from the $24 down to $14 and because they could. And this is one of those moments where you go, if you were paying the heroes and those essential workers $24 an hour to get you the profits that you made, that seems like that's a good place to start to make the part-timer's wage.
Right. A good place to start. And that's all we're asking. You can start at that wage and keep going up, and also give our long tenure part-timers a catch-up raise to let them know that you appreciate them for all their long years of service. But for whatever reason, you know, and again, we don't know, that could be happening, but we just don't know.
Yeah.
We just don't know. And hopefully this anxiety, this frustration that all of us are feeling right now could, you know, go away. Because if not, you know, if we have to rush to do this, we don't want to rush. This is a contract that's going to be in place for the next 5 years. This is what we're going to use to take care of our families and better our lives and, just things that we need to take care of in our communities. So we need to make sure that we get that information out so we can explain it, go over it, address our members' concerns, answer their questions, and be upfront and transparent. Right now, a lot of that is not happening. It's just almost as if we're going to give you the information that we want you to have and not give you all the information so you can make the right decision. And that's going to take some time. 3 weeks is not enough time to make a decision based on what's going to happen for over the next 5 years.
Yeah, well, I agree with you on this, Richard. But, you know, here's the thing that I find most important is that I look at the members and looking, 97% of your members, voted to strike. It looks like all avenues are headed toward that. As someone who's been on strike in the past, I don't want that to happen. But this contract could be that industry setting contract that raises up others, you know, the Amazon workers that are organizing, that we want to make sure our employees, the FedEx workers, this could be that thing that buoys, you know, conditions for the entire industry up. So I think there's a lot more riding on this than just what your members get. Now, I want them to get what they earn, but there's a lot more on this, I think.
Yeah, you hit it on the head. And that's what this contract is all about as well. It's about lifting everybody up. And this is what this contract will do. If it ends the way that we want it to end, you're talking about those Amazon workers, the Walmart workers, the Target, anybody in that industry, in this industry, it will lift everybody up to that industry standard, right? And so, again, we need to make sure that's what's happening. And again, we don't want to sound like, you know, we don't know anything. There's some things that came out that sound good. But again, you know, what I found out over the last two contracts, we're not going to believe anything until we see it for ourselves, right? And again, this is not a shot at anybody. But again, we've learned that we need to see it on paper before we can totally agree. And I think that's what our members are looking for. We're looking for the evidence of what you're talking about. It's one thing to talk about it, but if we don't have it in front of our face, it's hard to explain to our members who are anxious right now, because we only have about 3 weeks left and they don't know about the wages. They don't know about progression. They don't know about are they going to have better access to health care? Is it going to change pension? We don't know anything, and that's not what you want this late in the game.
No, I'm right there with you. And the hope is that they get back to the bargaining table and they hammer this out. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Richard Hooker, Secretary Treasurer of Teamsters Local 623. Check out their website, teamsterslocal623.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Now, again, you know, I keep coming back to your members should get everything that they earn. This is a wildly profitable company, $13.9 billion in profit. They've done massive stock buybacks to enrich shareholders and the CEO and the executives. They've done all this stuff. There should be some trickle down. But for me, this is more than just, you know, your members. This is about society going, look, we work for these big companies. We work for these very profitable entities, whether it is, as you said, Walmart or Amazon or FedEx or any of them. Workers across the board should be looking to this going, you know, they're fighting for better wages, hours, conditions. We can and we should too. And I'm hoping this is that, you know, the 1934, you know, strike in Minneapolis, you know, was a huge push to make the trucking industry livable. This might be possibly, you know, when we look back, a historical moment that does the same thing in the delivery industry.
Yeah, I mean, this again, this could be another 1934 moment. Like you just mentioned, this could be another one of those once in a lifetime events where the workers win, and it changes the lives of every worker in the country, especially for those companies who make massive amounts of profit. This could change their lives because we have given them the blueprint, the prototype on how to do it. And if people look back and workers look back, even non-union workers, if they look back and say, hey, man, we can use this to form a union. Because if those workers over there at UPS can do it, we can too. We can too. And so I'm looking forward to this victory, and I'm looking forward to, you know, raising the wages for everybody, not just UPS workers or Amazon workers, FedEx workers, but for every worker.
Yep.
Have their conditions raised, their wages raised, the quality of life raised, the community raised. That's what this is about, and I'm looking forward to that.
So I know across the country, and I know you're part of it in Philadelphia, there are these practice pickets going up, all these informational pickets going on. What do you want people to know when they see this? I keep saying I want people to adopt a striker. You know, go find someone on the picket line, spend a day with them, bring them a cup of coffee, a water or something, a box of donuts, I don't know. But go out and walk the picket line, experience it, and hear people's stories. What are you prepping for?
Well, what we're hoping for is really get our members acclimated to what it's going to look like if it happens on August the 1st. Give them a prequel to what we're going to be expecting from them if this works, but also send a message to the company that we're just practicing in preparation for what's going to happen on August 1st. And also give the public a visual on what it's going to look like to see 340,000 workers walking up and down the street demanding more, you know, crying out, screaming, fussing, you know, letting the company know you caused this. You caused us to be out here, right? And we're not just going to take what you're giving us. Strikes are a sacrifice. They are a sacrifice to, you know, our families. And they are a sacrifice to, you know, each individual. We're letting the company know that we've had enough and we're willing to sacrifice to get more. That's what it is. It's really the ultimate sacrifice for a worker when they go on strike because we have had enough and we want more.
This is the last arrow in the quiver. And it's, you know, to be honest, you're fighting for your fair share. And that's noble. I wish you guys the best. And if this does happen, I hope you'll come back and share some more with us, especially as the negotiations happen. And ultimately, if a strike is needed, most certainly would love to have you back.
We'll be there. Thank you.
Good luck, Richard. Appreciate it, man.
All right. Thank you so much.
Good stuff. Richard Hooker. Make sure you check out their website, TeamstersLocal623.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. But I tell you, give him credit. Out there at this time,
the year was 1892.
It is what it is.
At 3
we'll take a quick break, right
an
back.
An alarm sounded in the town of Homestead, Pennsylvania. The steel workers who lived in the town were on strike. Andrew Carnegie was the owner of the mill located just outside of Pittsburgh. The Carnegie Steel Company was making massive profits, a record $4.5 million just before the 1892 confrontation. Even so, Andrew Carnegie was determined to lower the cost of production by breaking the union. As the union's three-year contract was coming to an end in 1892, the company demanded drastic wage cuts. During the contract negotiations, management didn't make proposals to negotiate, instead issued ultimatums to the union. The local newspaper pointed out that it was not so much a question of disagreement as to wages, but a design upon labor organization. The manager of the mill, Henry Clay Frick, tried to bring in the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, which was known for infiltrating unions and breaking strikes. The workers were determined not to let the Pinkertons into the mill. For 14 hours, the workers battled with the Pinkertons and attempted to sink their barge. At the end of the battle, 9 workers and 3 Pinkertons lay dead. 4 days later, 8,500 National Guard forces were sent at Frick's request to take control of the town and steel mill. After winning his victories, Frick announced, "Under no circumstances will we have any further dealings with the Amalgamated Association as an organization. This is final." This incident is worth remembering because today, many people are intent on crushing any attempts by workers to organize.
I was born coal fields of Kentucky. I moved north in 73.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. Found a job.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. I want to jump into the mailbag real quick. Got a number of emails I want to get to. Marianne asked the question, why I don't support RFK Jr. Other than, you know, Marianne laughing of why. Have you not been paying attention? Have you not been listening? I said from the beginning, I think RFK Jr. is a kook. I'm sorry, you know, his heroin days. I think, you know, scrambled the brains a little bit. But beside that, you know, the most recent little bit of RFK Jr. kookery, evidently he believes that, you know, I guess he believes that, as the guy who was interviewing, that Hitler was set up. Evidently, he praised this James Corbett, a Sandy Hook denier, a 9/11 conspiracy theorist who claimed that Hitler was a Rothschild and that Hitler and the Nazis were 100% completely and utterly set up by the international banking community. And when you hear that, think Jew. And, you know, and the international crony capitalists, you know, think, Prescott Bush. But RFK, you praise this guy. You go, really? I think you should probably, if you really want to be president, if that's what you're really trying to do, maybe pick better friends. You know, don't have picture taken with you and Michael Flynn and Roger Stone. Just, I mean, if you're going to run as a Democrat, just kind of throwing that out there. And the anti-vax kookery, I had enough with RFK Jr., you know, 20 years ago. When, you know, he got me all worked up and, you know, that, you know, the vaccines that we were going to give our daughter were going to cause autism. Fortunately, you know, I trust my family doctor much more than I trust a former heroin addict kook. And we did, you know, what we did. But this guy's dangerous. And he's got the Kennedy name. So people are like, oh, he must be. No, guy's a kook. At least my thought. I got an email from Betsy, says, Rick, I'm not sure if you saw this, but Texas, through their anti-abortion law, there are more children being born now than there have been in past years. And she points to an article that says because of the anti-abortion laws in Texas that took effect in 2021, that in the 9 months in 2022, the last 9 months, there were 10,000 more births than would have been otherwise. And they look at this stuff, you know, over years to see how many kids are normally born and look at, there's a calculation that goes in there's 10,000 more than they expected. And that's Betsy's point that, you know, it's working. And I'm going, you know, how is it working? More children are going to be born. Okay. What are we going to do to support them? You know, how many of these people how many of these kids are going to be born into low wage situations or all, you name it. And how are we going to take care of them? What are we going to do to ensure that through policy that they get education and health care and food and all the things that they need? You know, and no crickets on that front. But look, I guess there's going to be more cheap labor. Yeah, I guess so. Marianne sent me an email, asked, that's RFK. Sorry. I already did that one. John asked why Nixon passed OSHA? Why was it necessary back then? How is it that a Republican got OSHA pushed through? And also, did I know that Nixon was in favor of a national health care program? You know, I understand, you know, Nixon wasn't today's Republican. They actually wanted to get things done. And also understand, the labor movement was much more powerful back then. You know, you go back to 1952, when, you know, the labor, when the Wall Street Journal said that they feared that the labor press had grown so powerful, that there was so much labor news, you know, newspapers and pamphlets and radio programs and comic books and, you know, all kinds of ways of touching workers that the labor movement had produced and used to bring people, you know, on board, that they feared that the labor press was going to sway the election and in a, you know, having President Adlai Stevenson didn't happen, but it was one of the things that the Wall Street Journal was concerned about. You know, now you hardly see any labor press or any, you know, any labor media. So Republicans have been able to walk away because they don't fear the workers anymore. They've gerrymandered things so badly that they don't fear the working people because we've nicely divided ourselves up into red hat and blue hat. They don't care about us anymore. So even, you know, the OSHA of the time wasn't very strong. It, you know, taken, you know, a little bit of time to increase, but it gave workers rights, as, you know, Jordan Barab said before, that they never had before. And by educating workers into, you know, how to protect themselves, we're able to use those laws. And they did that through their unions. And this is why, again, I'm such a, if you go, Rick, you sound like a broken record. It's because this is how we built the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. This is how we built the 20th century American dream. And it's been Republicans over the last, you know, 50 years, 70 years, 80 years, who have been standing firmly in the way and destroying it. Now, again, Nixon had to make that outreach. In fact, you know, George Meany, the head of the AFL-CIO, a conservative labor leader, was seen often in the Oval Office with Nixon. We don't have that today because one party, Republicans, are hell-bent on destroying organized labor, hell-bent on destroying workers' rights, hell-bent on destroying what little rights working people have. Want to go back to the good old days, you know, when it was a master-servant relationship. One of those things that at some point, you know, we have to, and I ask my Republican friends, please take your party back to saying, I wish there were pro-labor Republicans again. I wish there were Republicans who go, no, we need to protect people on the job. That it's appalling what they did in Texas. It's appalling that they would pass these preemption laws, you know, the party of smaller, less intrusive government that's going to make workers more vulnerable. It's appalling that Republicans continue to attack child labor laws, unemployment, workers' compensation, all of the things that built that prosperous working class. Now understand, they're pushing for the gig economy. Oh boy, they want that. Everyone should be their own LLC. Everyone should be their own corporation. So the main corporation has no liability. It's all on the weakest link. It's all on the least among us. So, you know, again, I keep coming back to the reality. We don't have the power. We've been divided and conquered. And the labor movement is how we bring that power back. It seems simple to me. You know, we're going to bring, you know, more children into this world. You know, this report from Texas, an additional 10,000 kids are needing to be housed and clothed and fed and all of that. And yet there's no policy. There's nothing there to, and you know, I would have been a little more okay with overturning Roe if on the next day they said, okay, we're going to pass a universal health care bill. We're going to pass a universal child care bill. We're going to make sure that families are able to support their kids. They're going to get the best education possible. There's something. We're going to make sure they get fed. You know, there were Republicans against Biden saying that by 2030, we're going to end childhood hunger. That is insane to me. As someone who grew up in a housing project where people were hungry, it's appalling to me in this country, the richest country on earth, that this happens. And that there are people advocating for it. That's the thing that blows my mind. And that the rest of us aren't holding them accountable by throwing the bums out. Because we got a lot of bums to throw out.
This is why elections have consequences. But as long as we're focused on all of this other stuff, other than what really matters, and that's what happens.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK 1260 AM Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News. I